This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing heart health in the preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum periods, as well as health disparities, with cardiologist Dr. Rachel M. Bond. Have a listen. Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark, and I'm a maternal fetal medicine specialist, and today I have with me Dr. Rachel Bond, cardiologist and pioneer and the course director of the Women's Heart and Vascular Symposium. On Instagram, you are, is it at Dr. Rachel M. Bond, correct?
Yes, Dr. Rachel M. Bond.
Perfect, perfect. So you can go to her account for some great information. And today what we're going to talk about is preconception heart health, which means before pregnancy. What we need to know, some things about heart health in pregnancy in the postpartum period. And then we're also going to talk about health disparities. Because as those of you guys who know my account, I do talk a lot about health disparities and maternal mortality. And cardiovascular disease is now the number one cause of maternal mortality in the United States. So it is definitely something that we need to discuss. So let's just start with a couple of stats. Cardiovascular disease affects approximately 1 in 4 of the nearly 4 million pregnancies each year in the United States. And the incidence of pregnancy in women or in pregnant individuals with congenital heart disease and acquired heart disease is on the rise. So can you just explain to the audience, what's the difference between congenital heart disease versus acquired heart disease?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So when we think about congenital heart disease, that implies that you were born with some sort of defect in the sense of how the structure of your heart should have been in a more normalized approach. It unfortunately wasn't that. And what we're noticing now is with congenital heart disease is that we're doing a phenomenal job in finding these patients earlier on and thus treating them earlier on. As a result, many of them are actually making it to adulthood where decades ago they were not. As such, we're now seeing many of them that are women wanting to become pregnant. And that in of itself implies that there definitely needs to be that collaboration between obstetricians, high-risk obstetricians, and myself as a cardiologist, or even perhaps a congenital specialist when we think about cardiology and cardiovascular disease. Now, acquired heart disease means not something you were per se born with, but you eventually developed for X number of reasons, the very commonality being risk factors. And when it comes to heart disease, we know it's something we could prevent 80% of the time. But as a result, several of our risk factors that do occur very early on in our life, like blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, if we're overweight, and if we're sedentary, or if we smoke or drink alcohol in excess, may place us at a higher risk for heart disease, that acquired form of heart disease.
Right. And as a maternal fetal medicine specialist, I'm definitely seeing, and I've been, you know, doing OB since 2000, more and more, like you said, of those individuals that had congenital heart defects, and some very significant ones, that the technology and this procedural, the surgeries are so good now that they get fixed and they're able to go on to be reproductive age and then have children. So, you know, obviously knowing the heart history, knowing, you know, what the actual defect was, what surgeries were done in someone with congenital heart disease, and then also differentiating between, like you said, acquired heart disease. And pregnancy is especially important because they're, you kind of take them down a little bit of different paths as far as management and what that could mean for pregnancy, as the pregnancy progresses and the physiological changes in pregnancy, especially towards the end of pregnancy, it could also change how you manage their labor and delivery process. For some heart issues, that might mean that a cesarean section is best. So having that good evaluation and multidisciplinary approach to the care of these individuals is so important for planning purposes, both for the pregnancy and the labor and delivery process. So I'm sure you're probably very well aware of that you get asked all the time, what should we do, or even when to deliver, can become an issue as well, depending on if the patient starts to become symptomatic from whatever their source of heart disease is as they get further along in pregnancy. So, you know, having a cardiologist on board and on the team is essential in patients like this. Would you agree?
Oh, 100%. Many patients actually are not alarmed, but they're just confused by the fact why cardiology is so intimately involved in those decisions. And I think delivery is one of those decisions we do help immensely in, because at times, should it be vaginal, based on the fact that maybe there will be less of a fluid shift and even the need to give an excess amount of fluids during the actual process, or should it be a cesarean section because XYZ? So we do help, I think, in that sense. And that's where, as you started the conversation, talking about multidisciplinary discussions, all of that comes into the mix.
Well, and let's not forget anesthesia. Anesthesia is crucial too. They're very important in the decision-making process as well, because they're the ones that are giving the anesthesia, whether it be by vaginal delivery, and the ones at the head of the table where we may not be. So having them on board and involved in the decision-making process is also important in patients with any kind of cardiovascular disease, whether it be congenital-based or acquired. Now, let's just talk a little bit about preconception. And preconception means before you get pregnant. Now, this can be for anyone who is actively trying to conceive, or someone who is considering starting to try to conceive, say, within the next year. What are some important things to know about your heart health in that time period before pregnancy even occurs? I'm sure you see a lot of patients in consultation, reproductive age individuals. So what are some of the important considerations when it comes to the preconception period?
So really, we are suggesting that ladies, particularly above the age of 20, every year go for what we call a wellness check. That wellness check should include their blood tests, looking at their cholesterol panel, their blood sugar levels. And in addition to that, checking their blood pressure, making sure that their weight is appropriate for their height, and really factoring in on those other risk factors that I mentioned. Included in that, though, are really more female-specific factors that may, unfortunately, at times make it difficult to conceive, but also may place them at a higher risk for heart disease, such as polycystic ovarian syndrome, as an example. And identifying which patients have such risk factors will allow us as cardiologists to quantify, well, do we believe you would benefit from being placed on medications that may lower your risk, as an example of preeclampsia, a condition where your blood pressure gets very elevated and it may affect your organs, including your heart, both during the pregnancy, but also after pregnancy? Or it may lead to the fact, how often should we as cardiology be involved in your care during your actual pregnancy, but also your postpartum period, which is another important factor. So that preconception time really gives us an idea to figure out a nice blueprint for what your actual pregnancy delivery plan would look like, and even that postpartum period as well.
Yeah, so getting a preconception consult with someone like Dr. Bond, a cardiologist, if you have a cardiovascular history, even, and what I see all the time are the young ones, the ones that had a congenital heart defect repaired, who did well and may not have seen any kind of physician and any cardiologist for years, and then all of a sudden they're pregnant. And then, of course, it becomes an issue. Then I start to panic. What exactly would happen? Well, I need your operative reports. I need to know. We have to play catch up. So ideally, and this is for any medical condition, or particularly when it comes to the heart, it's better to get that all squared away in a nice little box with a bow before pregnancy occurs, because then we don't have to play catch up. So if you know that you have a cardiovascular history, you had a congenital heart defect that was repaired, no matter what it was, you've been diagnosed with some kind of cardiomyopathy, you have longstanding chronic hypertension, and now you're a little bit older and maybe haven't been evaluated, approaching the age of 38, 39, 40, you know, seeing a maternal fetal medicine specialist like myself, seeing a cardiologist to just get a baseline assessment to see what we're dealing with preconceptionally is so much better than having to do it when you're pregnant and then crossing our fingers and hoping that we can play catch up and get you where you need to be. Is that right? Would you agree with that?
100%. And as you very nicely said, it's not just for those who have congenital or acquired heart disease. It's also for those that have those risk factors that can lead to that acquired heart disease. The sooner we figure out, again, what your risk may be, the easier it will be to get you through that pregnancy, figure out a proper delivery plan for you, and make sure that we follow you along even after the delivery.
And then one other thing, if you know there's a significant heart history in your family, even if it doesn't affect you, that's also something to let your provider know, because that could potentially affect you in pregnancy. So what would be a couple of examples of something that maybe runs in the family that may not particularly affect that individual at the time, but might be important for us to know?
Well, even to the same degree, a history, a family history of preeclampsia, definitely now we're seeing data suggest that that definitely places you at a heightened risk of that. And that, again, being an adverse pregnancy complication that can affect your heart later on in life. But beyond that, when we think about the cardiovascular system, we know anyone who's had a premature cardiac event for a male first degree relative, which means you're father or your sibling above the age of 55, and for a female above the age of 65, which would mean your mother or your sibling as well, we know that having a myocardial infarction, like a heart attack as an example, or having a cardiac event beyond just the heart, the arteries itself, such as a weakening of the heart muscle, or even perhaps even having a cerebral event like a stroke, those are risk factors, and that can definitely disproportionately affect you and make you at a higher risk. So it's very, very important to ask your parents, ask your siblings, how is your heart health, especially during pregnancy? Ask them, did they have any complications at all during pregnancy? Was blood pressure problematic for them? Because there is a possibility it may translate into what happens to you.
Yeah. Well, I was just talking to someone the other day about a different topic, and knowing your family history, sometimes it seems annoying when you go to your doctor's office and they ask you about your family history and you're trying to check out everything. There's a reason why we ask for that, because that can apply to you. And there are certain red flags that we look at in your family history that we are like, you know what, we better check this out. So it's not just because we want to irritate you with a lot of paperwork. It's because we want to know, because there are things in your family history that could apply to you and could, especially in pregnancy, end up being an issue for you in your pregnancy. So, I always recommend, and I talked to Dr. Irabunda a while on how to advocate for your health, keeping a log, like of a spiral notebook of all the procedures you've had, medications you've been on, anything you know new about your family history, so it's all in one place, so that you can have that information there, and it'll be easy to refer to. Just kind of keeping your own little family history, personal history of any medical conditions that could be applicable to you later down the road. So that's one little nugget I like to give about family history, because I know I'm not the best about it myself, but I started doing it recently and it does make a difference. Okay, let's move along to cardiovascular health and pregnancy. Now, common things that we see that happens is acquired heart disease is more the issues that we deal with in pregnancy. Those that with congenital heart defects usually come in knowing they've had the heart surgeries and have had good follow-up for the most part. But some of the more common presentations of acquired heart disease and pregnancy and the postpartum period, and we'll get to the postpartum period, are heart failure, myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, arrhythmia. We see that a lot. Having palpitations, my heart's skipping a beat, my heart is racing, those types of complaints that we see from patients. And then something called aortic dissection. We don't want really to get into that a whole lot. That's very, very rare, although that can happen. We'll focus on the others a little bit more. But what is it about pregnancy that can reveal some of the underlying cardiovascular issues that the patient may not even have known they had?
Yeah, I mean, pregnancy is really a window to our future health. We think about that all the time, but we also say as cardiologists that it's the first stress test typically that a female encounters. Why? We have an increase in your pulse rate, an increase in the amount of volume that's in your body that your heart has to push out and pump out. And as a result, it does have to work harder. And by working harder, it can sometimes expose any underlying conditions that we may have missed because they were either not followed through or at the time you just were not having any symptoms. So a lot of times women may present for the first time during their pregnancy with a lot of the signs and symptoms that could make us want to explore. So what are those signs and symptoms we have to think about? So shortness of breath, that really is not necessarily just occurring when you're exerting yourself, but possibly even now at rest. Maybe you're needing to sleep with more pillows at night because when you lay flat, you feel very, very winded and short of breath. Maybe you're noticing that, okay, it's normal to have swelling. 80% of the time women during pregnancy have swelling in their legs, but the swelling that doesn't necessarily go away when you elevate your legs, that is concerning. Maybe you're having pain or pressure in your chest, which is another alarming sign that would mean, okay, you probably need to see a cardiologist so we can make a decision. Do we need to do more testing, more imaging to really see structurally what's going on with your heart?
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about too is, you know, the symptoms of, and this is why it's one of the causes of maternal mortality. The symptoms of underlying cardiovascular condition can overlap with what's considered the normal changes in pregnancy. Oh, well, that's normal. You're pregnant. That's normal. And I mentioned this before. We've got to stop with that mentality and assuming that this shortness of breath they're having, this chest pain they're having, this, you know, not being able to sleep or the, you know, any kind of cardiovascular type complaint is, oh, it's just pregnancy. It'll go away once you deliver. What is your advice as a cardiologist? Let's talk first about the patient to the patient who just knows something's not right. And maybe some doctor, obstetrical care provider, emergency room physician just said, you know what? It's just, you're pregnant. It'll go away.
Yeah, so that happens quite often, mm-hmm. unfortunately, and I do think it's a leading driver as to why we're seeing such high rates of poor outcomes during pregnancy. What I suggest to all my patients is, one, you know your body better than mm-hmm. any of us ever could. It is not, if it's not normal to you, it's not normal. And it's at that point in time where if you are speaking to, be it your obstetrician, your primary care physician, and they're not necessarily listening to you, that you can ask and request and more importantly, seek a second opinion. That way, somebody who then starts to listen to you can actually explore the signs and symptoms that you're actually worried about. A rule of thumb for the most part, as I said, is that if these symptoms are occurring at rest, but more importantly, if they're perseverating and more, even more so importantly, getting worse, that's not normal. And that's really when their alarm signs need to come off and we need to say, something needs to be done. Let's refer you to a cardiac specialist who can do further testing. Mm-hmm. And if everything structurally looks good, wonderful, then mm-hmm. we can say that it is pregnancy, but it's really a diagnosis of exclusion at the mm-hmm. end of the day, especially for those that have risk factors, which we discussed, but more importantly, yeah. those that are having ongoing symptoms.
And just if there's any obstetrical care providers that are listening, it's not going to hurt. Most of the time, it's going to probably be nothing, but you'd rather it be nothing than to assume it was nothing and then something bad happens. We have to do our due diligence. Cardiovascular disease is now the leading cause of maternal mortality, and we have to treat it as such, and we have to take it seriously. Dismissing our pregnant individuals and telling them, oh, it's just pregnancy, that whole mentality has to stop because that's what's killing our patients. So we have to kind of shift gears, change the narrative, listen to our patients, ask more questions, sit down with them. And if you personally don't have the time, and look, obstetrical care providers are busy, I get it, then refer them to someone who can do the proper workup. That is perfectly fine to do. Refer them to a cardiologist like Dr. Bond so that they can take a look at them and make sure that everything's okay. Don't just say it's just pregnancy because you need to get out of the room. And I'm being a little bit harsh here and go see the next what's happening and it needs to stop because we're overlooking a lot of signs and symptoms of underlying cardiovascular conditions because we're attributing it to normal pregnancy when it's not. So this is, you know, we have to do better. And another point I wanted to make also is that, and people ask me this all the time, I'm always doing live discussions about how to advocate for your own health. And people say, why do I always have to be the one advocating for my own health? And I agree. It shouldn't be that way. And we'll talk a little bit more about this a little bit later. But the healthcare system's not where it's supposed to be. And I don't know when it's going to be, especially when it comes to maternal care. But what I can do and what Dr. Bond can do is tell you what you need to do to stand up for yourself and advocate for yourself. What do you have to add to that? Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, the thing about women is we are always eager to advocate for our family, mm-hmm. our children, our friends. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to us, it's always very challenging. And this is what I always express to my patients, that in order to make sure that your children, your family, your friends are being taken well and being taken care of, you need to make sure you're being taken care of. So although it's not your job to say, what do you think about referring me to a cardiologist or what do you think about XYZ? It is important that you bring the conversation to the forefront because if you're not, chances are your providers may not be either. And as Dr. Clark said, we hope down the road, we won't have to have the patient really push this conversation forward as much And I am hopeful that through advocacy, we maybe won't have to, because we definitely are retraining our residents and our fellows on how to focus in on, again, the patient and have more patient provider decision and conversations. But until that time comes, I do think it's important for you to be your number one advocate.
Yeah, and this, I don't want people to think that I'm taking obstetric or putting obstetrical care providers, they're off the hook. They're not. We have to do better. But we can also empower you to advocate for yourself by having these types of conversations. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm just saying it's all your responsibility. It shouldn't be. And one day, I know one day it's going to be better to where we're on the other side of this. Hopefully soon.
Hopefully.
One of these days. Yeah, right. Cardiovascular, let's talk about postpartum. A lot of things happen between pregnancy, delivery, and the postpartum period. And we're not out of the woods when that baby comes out. Things can happen to our cardiovascular health in the postpartum period. Talk about some of those things that we need to look for. And it's not just the immediate postpartum period. It's not just the first week, the second week, 6 weeks. It can be up to a year postpartum where there's still a risk for some individuals. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, we actually know that a third of mortality occurs from 6 weeks up to a year postpartum. Mm-hmm. Why is that important? It's important because we really need to be making sure that anyone who had an adverse pregnancy outcome, such as preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, gestational high blood pressure, a premature labor, or even having a notable amount of hemorrhage during their pregnancy, can place them at a higher risk for cardiovascular disease in the future. And it's that year that we really need to keep a close eye on these moms. We need to monitor their blood pressures. Eventually down the road, we need to look for those other traditional risk factors that we talked about, the cholesterol, the blood sugar, the weight, making sure they're exercising, et cetera, to ensure that they are focusing on ideal cardiovascular health. And it's important that they're aware that this will be a lifelong relationship. A lot of these moms who've had adverse pregnancy outcomes, I see them once we get them through that first year, typically every year thereafter, to ensure we're focusing in on prevention. As I said at the beginning, heart disease is something we could prevent 80% of the time. It's just a matter of the fact that we provide you with the tools on how to do that. And one of the tools is making sure you see a physician who's focusing in on a lot of these risk factors.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're a patient who has had gestational hypertension, preeclampsia, severe preeclampsia, if you had to be delivered early because you had early onset preeclampsia, if you were a chronic hypertensive, meaning you came into the pregnancy with known chronic hypertension or high blood pressure, and then you developed preeclampsia on top of that, if you had any kind of heart dysfunction as related to your preeclampsia, and you had diabetes, all of those things don't just magically go away once you've delivered. For the most part, the younger people will recover and do just fine, but that's not to be said, especially the older you are, but it can happen to anybody. This is something that needs to be followed up to a year at least, if not more, depending on how you recover and your cardiovascular health recovers over time. So I want one important message is, once the baby's here doesn't mean it all magically goes away. There's still consequences, right?
Absolutely. There are consequences. And honestly, if we have those mothers during the actual delivery that are seeing the obstetrician, we want to make sure that they're seeing myself as a cardiologist within 7 days after those adverse pregnancy outcomes. There we can get that established relationship if we didn't meet them even in the hospital. And there are times when I may be called during their hospitalization because they are very sick, they have severe preeclampsia, or perhaps, as you mentioned earlier, a weakening of their heart muscle. But we want to make sure that they have that very close follow-up. And even after we get past that pivotal fourth trimester, the risk still exists. And that's where we make a decision on how often and how frequent they will still need to be seen from both the obstetrician, the primary doctor, as well as me as a cardiologist.
Yeah, and one important thing to note here as well is that, you know, myself, most of my patients are indigent and on Medicaid, and they lose funding after a certain period of time. So if you have one of those patients, or you are one of those patients, and you had severe preeclampsia, if you had an issue with your heart in your pregnancy, get a referral. Make sure you ask for that before you're discharged. I need to go see a cardiologist while I still have funding. So we can at least get that first appointment seen and get something established in some kind of healthcare, something to be done before you lose funding. Sometimes once, if there's a diagnosis, that funding can be extended depending, every state's a little bit different, but there are things that can be done. So there's nothing wrong with asking for a referral in those first 6 weeks after you deliver before your Medicaid funding runs out. And in fact, I encourage it, because at least it'll get covered. And if anything is found underlying, then maybe it can be addressed in another way. So that's something to consider for yourself as a patient who may be on Medicaid or pregnancy Medicaid and will lose it a certain period of time. Or if you are a physician who have those types of patients, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And our hope is that through advocacy, we won't come to this, right? Yes. As it stands mm-hmm. right now, we know that many states are preventing access after 6 weeks, unfortunately. Yes. And we are working very vigorously to try mm-hmm. to extend that to at least 1 year, because it's, again, that 1 year after delivery that's the most vulnerable for all of these mothers. So hopefully we'll see some improvements. I know through a lot of the societies I work for, we're definitely advocating for that.
Right. And I know some states are leading the way for that as well, to extend Medicaid coverage for those that deliver. And hopefully all the rest of the states will follow suit. All right, let's jump into some risk factors for maternal cardiovascular disease. Let's talk, and we're going to go more in depth after this little snippet here about health disparities in particular. But one of the biggest risk factors is non-Hispanic Black race. Why?
So that's a perfect question, because mm-hmm. we probably would say that's the number one risk mm-hmm. factor. And I pause because I want to make it very clear that it's not the genetics of that. It's actually the social aspects of being a non-Hispanic Black female in the United States. So what does that imply? That implies where we were brought up, where we are living, where we work, where we play, what our access to healthy living is, such as a healthy environment, a healthy work environment, healthy eating habits, the ability to exercise and make sure we're in a safe environment that has a notable reduction of stress. And I bring up stress because we know that chronic stress in of itself, just being a Black female in America through misogyny and coupling that with institutional and structural racism, is in of itself a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, as well as a multitude of other chronic medical conditions. Mm-hmm. But it leads to premature medical conditions like high blood pressure, blood sugar issues, cholesterol issues, all of which then couple and lead to heart disease. So when we think about race in of itself, it's all the social aspects mm-hmm. of it, with unfortunately racism being at the core. And I think that in of itself is what we as clinicians do have to do a better job at, is in terms of empathizing with our patients that come from these vulnerable populations and understanding what their plight was. And more importantly, figuring out if there's any roadblocks that are preventing them from getting the same exact care as somebody who may look a little different than them as well.
So, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm in a teaching institution is, you know, you look at preterm labor, you look at someone's chances of success for achieving a vaginal birth after cesarean. And race is always something that places them at higher risk. And my question is there something biologically different about that Black woman that does not allow her to have a vaginal birth after cesarean? Or is it something else? And majority of the time it's something else. And it's just the things that you just mentioned. So race as a risk factor has to be looked at for what it is. It's not because there's something biologically, the makeup, something innate with that person because of the color of their skin is what's making them have a risk factor. It's everything that Dr. Bond just mentioned. And that's what we have to understand in medicine and be attuned to and be willing to accept is, why is that person at increased risk of preterm labor? Because they're Black. It's not because there's something different about their body. It's because of everything that Dr. Bond just said. And why are they at increased risk for cardiovascular events? It's not because there's something biologically different. It's because of everything that Dr. Bond just said. So if you are a patient, if you are a provider, if you're a medical student, we have to educate ourselves on that, because we don't get enough education in medical school on it. We don't. Not nearly enough. So a lot of times we have to seek that on our own. Would you agree with that? I mean, I don't know you. You're a lot younger than me. You may have gotten so more education, but I know I did not have one class on health disparities coming up.
No, and I think right now I applaud all of the program directors and the medical societies that are really trying to make this a focus. They really have revamped their curriculum because we have to. As it stands right now, we have to address the elephant in the room, which is again that it's that social aspects of race that are really leading to the disparities that we see. And until we do that, we're not going to see any change. We're not.
Exactly, and you're exactly right. Mitch, I'm just going to go through a few of the other the risk factors. Age older than 40, like it or not, if you're a healthy 41-year-old, you ran marathons, you did everything right, you eat healthy, you're not a smoker, you're not a drinker, and you get pregnant after 40, you're still at increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes based on age alone, like it or not. We have to understand what those are. And maternal cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events after age 40 is one of them. Obesity, and Dr. Bond touched on that, is also a risk factor. We already talked about hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. Having, and also coming into the pregnancy with having had chronic hypertension. Chronic hypertension just means you developed high blood pressure, then got pregnant. We call it chronic hypertension. Knowing that you have that is also a risk factor for having a maternal cardiovascular disease. A few other things, and you mentioned a history of preterm delivery, which people would not think, would, but it does. Strong family history of heart disease, we talked about. Obstructive sleep apnea. I can't tell you how many times I have diagnosed that in someone who's pregnant because things change when you're pregnant and it really brings that to the forefront. Do you see that a lot?
Oh, it's quite, it's actually under one, I would say it's underdiagnosed, but it's very obvious for us as clinicians to actually diagnose it. When we think about obstructive sleep apnea, why it is a risk factor, we know that when untreated, and that's the most important thing to focus on, it's not the actual condition itself, it's the undertreatment of it. It can change the structure and shape of your heart, making you more prone to arrhythmias, a very common arrhythmia being atrial fibrillation, where the top of your heart is really quivering and fluttering and not necessarily working in the right path it should. In addition, it could affect your blood pressure. And a lot of times that could be a reason, at least for myself, if I'm seeing a very, very young lady who's coming to me for the first time with elevated blood pressure, we diagnose her with chronic hypertension, I may order a sleep study just to see if there's any underlying cause, such as sleep apnea, that's driving it.
Right. So if you have any of these risk factors and you're thinking about trying to conceive or within the next few years, make sure that you have someone that's taking care of you and managing you for these conditions so that they are what I always say optimally controlled. It is okay to get pregnant and have underlying chronic medical conditions. People are going to have babies and have underlying chronic, whether it's diabetes, high blood pressure, they're going to. But having them optimally controlled before the pregnancy is ideal. I'm never going to say to somebody, oh, you have chronic hypertension, you should not have a baby. That's just ridiculous. But what I can say is make sure you get that optimally controlled, your sleep apnea, whatever risk factor you might have that would increase your risk of a cardiovascular event or disease and worsening in pregnancy, get that optimally controlled and evaluated and medicated if necessary prior to conception. What would you add to that?
Oh, I 100% agree. I don't want to scare any of the ladies out there that have any of these conditions to think that, oh my God, should I not have a baby? No, the answer is you should. We just want to emphasize that we want to make sure it's optimal, ideal, and appropriate before you venture into your pregnancy.
And we talked about some of the symptoms that, and I'm just symptoms of cardiovascular disease. And listen, it's not easy, and we're not telling you have to figure out, is it pregnancy related or is something else going on? It's our job, but it's your job to make sure we know that it's happening. So you talked about shortness of breath. The way I explain it to my patients is like every pregnant patient is short of breath, but if you're finding that you're walking up a flight of steps and you're gonna have to stop and you're gonna, or if you're at rest and you're short of breath in a car ride, okay? Or if it's taking you a lot longer to recover from walking to the bathroom and back. If the swelling is starting to happen either earlier in pregnancy or to a greater degree, that's another sign that something could be going on. We talked about chest pain. Chest pain's a hard one to say this is pregnancy related, this is not. I just think if anyone in pregnancy is having chest pain, they need to be evaluated. A lot of times what we find is that it's reflux, but you know, it's too hard for me to say this means it's pregnancy related, this means it's not. If you're having chest pain and you're pregnant, be evaluated. And then the other thing is syncope. One thing we didn't talk about is syncope. What is syncope? How is that a sign of cardiovascular disease?
So syncope means just passing out and losing consciousness. So the act of that is definitely not something normal, irrespective of if you're pregnant or not. If you're having periods where you lose consciousness, you need to be evaluated for a cardiovascular condition. What we would be most commonly doing would be making sure we look and do an ultrasound of your heart to rule out that there's nothing structurally causing that, something you were born with or something you acquired, right? Going back to that congenital aspect and going back to that acquired aspect. But passing out, irrespective of if you're pregnant or not, is never normal. And it's definitely something that warrants you to see a heart specialist.
Yeah. And again, I'll just add, if, and I hear this all the time, if you're getting seen and you're not getting a physical exam, they're not listening to your heart, they're not potentially recommending an echo of your heart, at least, at the very least, an EKG, and they're just saying you're pregnant, ask for a second opinion, ask to be seen by somebody else. That's not, should not be the first thing that someone says without having done the proper workup. We deserve, you know, everybody deserves that for presenting, no matter what they come for. And we just can't keep dismissing and saying it's pregnancy related. Again, that's how we lose patients, is when we just assume it's pregnancy related. So it's okay to advocate for yourself. It's okay to have an advocate in the room. It's okay if you happen to be by yourself to see, you know what, can you call my mom, my sister, my significant other, and while they're on the phone, tell me what's going on. Have someone else listen in so they can ask questions as well. You don't have to do this on your own. I know COVID changes everything, and sometimes it is just you in the room. Somebody else, I FaceTime with family members all the time. All the time. And we should all be willing to do that as providers. So if you're being denied that, that's a problem and that's a red flag, and you have the right to ask for a second opinion or have someone else to see you. Okay. Let's go into, we already talked about this, cardiovascular disease, cardiomyopathy, the leading causes of pregnancy related mortality. Cardiovascular disease affects, like we said, 1 in 4% of pregnancies per year in the U.S. And cardiomyopathy is a leading cause of deaths 1 week to 1 year after delivery. You mentioned this, but talk a little bit more. What is cardiomyopathy?
Absolutely. So there is a phenomenon called peripartum or postpartum cardiomyopathy. As it stands right now, we don't know the exact cause or culprit. What we think may happen is the surge of adrenaline that occurs during pregnancy may take a toll on the muscle of the heart. And the heart is a muscle. And as a result, it starts to weaken and weaken. A lot of times, the first presenting symptom or sign may be that shortness of breath or that you're gaining an excess amount of weight. I always tell patients that, wait, when you weigh yourself, if you've gained more than 2 pounds in a 24-hour period, that's not food, right? That's not normal. That's most probably water weight. And that's where we need to be concerned that there's a possibility your heart is not pumping as well as it should. With cardiomyopathy, we know that it's very pivotal for us to diagnose it sooner rather than later, because we can do a lot of measures to try to help rebuild the muscle of the heart. That would be in the effect of putting you on medications. Yeah. That definitely help to strengthen that. And then it would also be having a conversation about future pregnancies, because depending on if that muscle recovers or not, it may be dangerous to actually have or attempt to have another baby. So there's a lot that comes in this peripartum or postpartum cardiomyopathy, which interestingly enough does disproportionately affect more people from African descent and ancestry than other races and ethnicities.
Yeah, and another thing is to make sure you have an accurate diagnosis of peripartum or postpartum cardiomyopathy, because I see it in charts all the time, but the patient also had preeclampsia. They also had other risk factors. Peripartum cardiomyopathy really is a diagnosis of exclusion. That means, you know, and then there are certain things we could see on the echo as well. And the reason why that's important is because cardiomyopathy associated with something like preeclampsia versus true, legit peripartum cardiomyopathy are two very different diagnoses and mean different things for future pregnancies. Okay. And I've seen patients been told, you had peripartum cardiomyopathy, you can never have another baby again, which first is wrong. There's certain factors that you have, even if you had it, that we look for over time to see how your heart recovers before making that kind of recommendation, even for those that truly have peripartum cardiomyopathy. Plus, if it's from something like preeclampsia, there's certain things we see on the echo or the ultrasound of your heart that look different that would suggest that it's not actually peripartum cardiomyopathy. It's cardiomyopathy resulting from the high blood pressure or the preeclampsia. So getting an accurate diagnosis is key. So my two cents on this is if you are being diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, peripartum, or any kind, maternal fetal medicine should be on board, as is should cardiology. They should be involved in making that kind of diagnosis because having an accurate diagnosis is crucial. Would you agree to that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And everything that you said is exactly what I say to all of my patients. Yeah. I get so many consultations where they have been told in the past they had peripartum, but we find out it was actually just preeclampsia with severe features, mm-hmm. and that led to it. So it's very important. And even if that implies getting your medical records, yeah. so you can have a thoughtful discussion with that provider who is now taking on the responsibility to actually properly diagnose you, I would highly suggest it and encourage it, because it could mean a matter of having a future pregnancy, possibly not mm-hmm. having a future pregnancy, figuring out how to best manage you. And right. It's very different. It's a very different pathway.
Exactly. Exactly. And so accurate diagnosis is key. Yes. Okay. So there's four risks. We've already talked about risk factors, but there's four that I want to touch on a little bit. And the first, and you did go into this, is race ethnicity. Non-Hispanic Black women have a 3.4 times higher risk of dying from COVID. I saw CVD and thought of COVID. Sorry, not COVID. Cardiovascular. You know, COVID's on
the
line.
Also have, though, to COVID. You're right.
Related pregnancy complications when compared to non-Hispanic white women. And you touched on this a little bit, but let's just talk about the elephant in the room. Why? We've already established it's not anything biological. There's other factors at play. And before you go into it, I also want to say this. I see, and I want to talk about the difficult patient that oftentimes is a Black patient. And they may be very sick, but because they're being difficult, they're either being dismissed or attributing whatever symptoms they're having because they're just not a nice patient. We have to think about, why are they being difficult?
Absolutely.
Why are they being difficult? And I hear it, and I've heard it over the years so many times. Until you pull up a chair and talk to them to see where it's coming from and understand the history that got them to where they are today and as sick as they are, why they're reacting that way or projecting that way, or why they are being quote unquote difficult. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because this is important for not just for cardiovascular disease and a sick pregnant patient or postpartum patient. It applies to anyone really, but expand on what I just talked about.
Absolutely. I think it's first important to highlight the fact that Black women in general, mm-hmm. regardless of, again, pregnant or not, over more than one in two or one out of two Black women in the United States have some form of cardiovascular disease over the age of 20. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, a lot of the risks are coming from high blood pressure, something that is very easily modifiable mm-hmm. through lifestyle, exercise, diet. As it stands right now, when we have patients that are coming to see us as providers, if we're not listening to them, mm-hmm. if we're not taking into account all of the experiences, the prior experiences, and even the lived experiences of their ancestors that they are focusing in mm-hmm. on as well, we are not doing a proper justice in terms of treating these patients. So we have to, as clinicians, one, learn a little bit about the mistrust mm-hmm. and why that mistrust exists. You hear a lot about it with COVID as an example, with the Tuskegee experiments mm-hmm. and other experiments, even in the OB world as an example, the presumed godfather, right, of obstetrics doing unfortunate experiments on Black women. But the fact is that we're still seeing this to this day, that those disparities exist. And as a result, many a times patients are coming with their guard up to the physician's office. And mm-hmm. I think that we have to take a step back and really empathize. And I bring up mm-hmm. empathy a lot because I think that we can do a better job by empathizing with these particular vulnerable patient populations. As it stands right now, we know that medical health systems that have a much more diverse form a workforce, such as clinicians, as an example, tend to treat patients of very diverse backgrounds slightly better. And I know that from a medical society perspective, we're working to diversify the field of medicine. I could even speak for myself as a cardiologist, a female cardiologist, but more importantly, a woman of color. I only make about 2%, and that's a very, very low percentage. But I do also know that several of my patients that look like me, they seek me out because they look like me, because they feel more comfortable.
Of course.
I will also say that obviously I do believe that me being part of my institution has helped those that may not be as diverse treat patients in the way that they should. So I think centering it back to what you brought up, yes, perhaps there may be concerns that there could be, you know, when dealing with specific patient populations, some what would be reported to be abrasive nature or difficulties, as an example, but it comes from that mistrust. And I think until we acknowledge it, we're not going to be treating these patients accordingly.
Yeah. And I think we have to understand that, and I'll give a patient the experience I had. I come on and I don't remember what room she is, room 14. She's been so difficult all night. And, you know, we can't do anything with her. She doesn't want to do anything we want to do. She, you know, needs this, but she's refusing. And it was a Black woman. I walk in, I pull up a chair and I say, listen, I understand you've had a rough night. I understand that there's some concerns. Start, list them one by one by one. What it boiled down to, she had a family member in a very similar situation that had a very poor medical outcome, and she was traumatized by it. And she was scared that it was going to happen to her. And until someone actually pulled up a chair and talked to her to figure out why, once I did that, it's like everything just kind of melted because someone tried to understand. And sometimes that's all that it takes. And we have to understand where it's coming from. And unfortunately, a lot of our Black patients have been through that way too much, not only themselves, but with family members, with loved ones, with friends. And they're afraid. They don't want it to happen to them. They're afraid whoever's in the room that doesn't look like them is not going to understand or care. And so we're going to have to make the effort to make sure they know that we care. And if that's what it means, what we need to do, then that's what we need to do. Until we do that, it's not going to change. Things are going to keep happening. And yeah, it might take more time. And I may have had 75 other patients to see. But the patient got treated. She had a good outcome. And everything was fine. And that's all that it took. So as providers, and especially in obstetrics, so we know we're losing moms, especially Black moms, at an alarming rate, we're going to have to take time to do this. I hope that any provider that's listening just takes that as an example. And I'm not patting myself on the back because it's my job. Most of my patients are women of color. That's where I work. And I have learned, I've taken an interest. I've educated myself. I've taken the time, and you can too, because it's going to make a difference in your patients' lives. What would you have to add to that? I mean, to teach us as providers how to do a better job.
Yeah, no, I think we definitely need to do a better job at just listening, as you did. I mean, just in that example, you took what could have been a very difficult and complex situation and really made it very easy. All that required was taking an extra 5 minutes of your day to sit down, get at the level of the patient and understand where this is coming from. Clearly, she was reacting to something, some trauma, and you were able to figure out what that trauma is. And we see this very commonly, but I think that we, in the day-to-day of being busy clinicians, don't do as good a job as just sitting down and actually listening. And I think once we start, we may actually see improvements.
Yeah. And then I wanted to, I'm going to just the other three risk factors, and we touched on that a little bit, were age, high blood pressure, and obesity. But I'm going to skip over that because we're going to run out of time here. But one, the last thing I want to talk about, and we hear about this all the time, and for those who don't understand, is what's called social determinants of disparities in cardiovascular disease and health and healthcare in general. What does it mean, social determinants? Because a lot of people may not understand what that means and why that's so important and why we're at today in maternal healthcare and also with maternal mortality. Explain to those that are listening What does that mean, and why is it important to understand that?
Yeah, we did touch slightly upon it earlier, but those are really the conditions that impact where you were born, where you were raised, where you grow up, and where you work. And they encompass, in addition to race and ethnicity, but more of the social aspects of that, they do more importantly encompass our socioeconomic status. It encompasses our access to healthy food, and it encompasses our ability to exercise and do all of the healthy measures that our clinicians or clinicians like ourselves tell our patients to do. One thing that I do want to emphasize, because I brought up socioeconomic status, is that when it comes to Black women in America, specifically during their maternal or pregnancy, we know that irrespective of their education or their income, they are still at a higher risk of dying and death. And it's a much, much higher risk, as you said, about 3.4 times the risk of those of other people of different race and ethnicity.
The latest stat for educated Black women is 5.2 times higher risk of dying in childbirth than their white counterparts. And that's staggering. So all these thoughts that education is protective, it's not protective. So that should tell you, anyone that's listening, something. Right. And I've talked about, I had a live discussion with another MFM and we discussed that. It is a real statistic and it is really happening. And we've heard about instances with like Serena Williams, Allyson Felix, other women of color, other Black women who were celebrities who still almost lost their lives. So that's still not protective.
It's not protective. And it just tells us that it's that patient population we really need to be focusing so much more on and actually, again, listening to.
So as someone who is a cardiologist, a healthcare provider taking care, and I am as well, what are some of the steps that pregnant women could take to help protect their heart health, both preconception, pregnancy, and in the postpartum period? What are some of the things that can be done to put them in a better position?
Yes. So you want to make sure that you do have preconception counseling. If you're thinking about having a child or building a family as an example, and when that preconception counseling starts, or more importantly, what it should be focusing in on is how to live a heart healthy lifestyle. I always reference the American Heart Association because they have 7 easy steps. That's making sure your blood pressure is under control, your cholesterol is under control, your blood sugar is under control, not smoking, not drinking alcohol in excess, eating healthy. And when we think about healthy eating, we definitely want to have a diet low in saturated fat, but high in the good omega-3 fat, a lot of which comes from salmon and other things of that nature. We also want to have a diet that's high in whole grains, as an example. We want to make sure that we're exercising, and exercising, it should be at least 150 minutes per week of some form of moderate cardio. That includes walking at a fast pace. So I always tell my patients there should be no excuses, because we should be able to incorporate that into our day-to-day, even if it's at work, taking the stairs instead of using the elevator as an example. And most importantly, making sure every year we're seeing a doctor. It doesn't have to be an obstetrician. It doesn't have to be a cardiologist. It really possibly should be a primary physician who's looking at those tests and making sure they're ideal and optimal, because then your risk once you become pregnant is so much lower than somebody who may not have those numbers ideal and optimal.
Yeah. And you know, those are all good things, you know, and advocate for yourself as well. If something doesn't seem right, don't be afraid to speak up. Don't feel like you're that patient, because you're wanting a better answer than what you're given. I have had a friend, and I'm sure you have too, as a physician, friends who are Black women who were being dismissed. And I had to tell their spouse, you're going to have to speak up. You're going to have to demand an answer and have your partner treated and seen. And because some people just say that's just not their nature. Now, it shouldn't get to that point. It shouldn't have to, but sometimes it does. So, you know, and that's okay. And that's okay. Yeah. If that's what it comes down to, then that's what it comes down to. Advocate for yourself. Like I said at the top of this, and I'm sure Dr. Bond agrees, hopefully we're going to be on the other side of that one day, to where it doesn't seem like I'm always telling patients to advocate for themselves, where the actual providers, healthcare providers all across the board are bearing the brunt of this so that the onus is not always on the patient. I do hope for that one day, at least in my lifetime as a physician. What about you?
100%. I mean, I live and breathe it, and I'm working to try to make sure that more people are in line with exactly what we talked about today. And if they're not, trying to change, right? To really listen to why they may have reservations or why they perhaps don't practice in a similar mindset. But one thing that, you know, Dr. Clark, as you mentioned, that's so important is that we need to make sure that these mothers and women that are thinking of having children understand that their voice is so important and pivotal, and they shouldn't be afraid to use it. We have it. You use it on your children. You use it on your friends. You use it on your loved ones. Let's start using it on ourselves, and you'll help in the outcomes that we're seeing right now.
I agree. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is very, very, a very good conversation. We need to have more conversations, not just on heart health, but other topics related to maternal care. We need to know what the health disparities exist in care in general. This is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we know that there are huge health disparities when it comes to breast cancer. Stillbirth Awareness Month, pregnancy and infant loss. And I've already talked about this on my account as well, about the disparities that exist in stillbirth. You know, it's across all levels of care. They have to be talked about. They have to be addressed. As providers, we have to know these stats, know why they exist, and fix them for anything to change, and be willing to fix them. So I hope this conversation here kind of helps for any providers that are listening to understand that it's time. We've got to do better. And so that our patients don't have to worry so much, and that it can be on us to make these changes. So thank you so much for Dr. Bond for taking your time out of your day to have this conversation with me at Dr. Rachel Bond on Instagram. You also have a link. What's the other for the Women's Cardiovascular Health Symposium? What's it called?
So my Instagram is at Dr. Rachel M, as in Marie Bond, and our Women's Heart and Vascular Symposium, which virtually is complimentary. It's Saturday, November 20th. The actual Instagram and link to that is at WHV Symposium. So you can feel free to join. We have wonderful content. We're actually talking about maternal health in the most vulnerable populations and some of the possible changes that we may be seeing in the near future on blood pressure guidelines as it centers around maternal health. So we really hope that you can join us. And thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'll put it in the comment. I'll put it in the caption, both links to Dr. Bond's Instagram account and the symposium's account, so you can get some information there. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. You too.
Right. Bye. Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on amniotic fluid embolism and birth trauma.